It can be confusing. I mean, a student might be sitting there and they're so impressed with their teacher, and he's their life has been enhanced by association with him, and yet they can see, and maybe they learn more and more as the longer they're there, that there's something wrong here in his behavior. But a lot of people just say, well, who am I to judge? You know, I'm just an ignorant schmuck, and this guy is supposed to be enlightened. And so, you know, maybe it's crazy wisdom. So I'll just keep sitting here. But it's not crazy wisdom. I it's not wisdom if it's that crazy.
Hello, everyone. And welcome back to the Free Radical Podcast, where we dive deep into those questions that will never leave us, probably. Who we are, what we are doing here, how can I give myself better, how can I love from a more wholesome place, an ongoing journey, an ongoing conversation. And in today's episode, I'm having a great pleasure and honor to have Rick Archer with me. So Rick is a creator and host of the interview show Buddha at the Gas Pump. Since the fall of 2009, he has interviewed over 725 spiritually awakening, as he will call them, people, from the well-known to the unknown, from a variety of backgrounds and traditions. A former transcendental meditation teacher for 25 years, Rick instructed hundreds of people and spent years of long meditation retreats. He has practiced meditation daily for over 55 years. He's also one of the founders of the Association for Spiritual Integrity and spoke regularly at the Science and Non-Duality Conference. So we've had a very interesting conversation with Rick, first in his car, then on his morning walk. We shifted scenarios for a moment on the theme of spiritual integrity or the role of ethics in spirituality, how you can be spiritually awakened, but maybe not necessarily grown up. The difference between holiness and wholeness, and the importance of feedback and holding ourselves accountable as teachers, what students are to look up in teachers, his life story as a teacher, as a practitioner, my own life story in between all that, and so many other topics that you can imagine filling in the in-between spaces. So this is a Free Radical Podcast. To support it, please subscribe to our channel by clicking on the bell. If you feel nourished by the conversation, like it, share it, drop out your comments to keep this conversation ongoing. Without further ado, dear friends, here's Rick Archer. Okay, dear Rick Archer, thanks so much for joining us in the Free Radical Podcast. Welcome.
You're welcome. I mean, thank you. Both.
Thank you for welcoming me. Yeah, it's always reciprocal. The conversation is always two-way street. So, very glad to know about you, of course. Most people may not know you directly by your name, some people, but I'm sure most people, if I say Buddha at the Gas Pump, will say, oh, yeah, I know that guy, so to say.
Right.
So if you allow me to begin there for a minute, because, of course, it's a very interesting project and contribution you've made. If I may ask you, what was the original impulse behind not only the project, but calling it Buddha at the Gas Pump? What I can glimpse immediately for me is, you are trying to signal finding the extraordinary Buddha in the ordinary, even the gas pump, the sacred and the profane. But you please let us know.
No, you're right. You're right. That's it. The way I found out about, the way it got started was that, I've been meditating since I was 18. I'm 75 now. And, with absolute regularity. I've never missed a meditation, couple hours a day, all that time. And so, spirituality has been a main focus of my life, although I spent, quite a few years just doing regular work to earn money. But, still staying on my spiritual routine. And for quite a few years, I was in this little group here in Fairfield, Iowa. We'd meet every Wednesday night. We'd call it a satsang. There was no teacher or anything. We just all sat around. And this is people who had been meditating for decades. And a lot of people were having spiritual awakenings. And we'd just talk about our experiences for a couple of hours. And I had a tendency to try to probe deeper and interview people. Like, I'd start asking them questions. And the guy who was hosting it in his living room said, stop interviewing people. You're supposed to just talk about your own experiences. So One day I was out in the garage working out on a Bowflex machine, which is like an exercise machine, listening to an Adyashanti recording. And I thought, you know, I should start an interview show where I actually interview people. Wow. And so I decided to start one. And initially I thought of it as something I would do on the local low power radio station here in town. And I had some vague idea of getting it out on the internet. But the radio station didn't want to do it. And so friends were encouraging me to just keep recording them at a local local public access TV station, which I did.
So and that started in which year, just to have an idea?
Oh, 2009.
Okay.
Yeah. And so then a friend of mine discovered I was doing this, and he was an old high school buddy, and he had a career in, as a video professional. And so he offered to turn them all into, you know, video files that I could upload to the internet. Mm. So I started doing that. And a friend of mine in that group, I was thinking of calling it Awakenings or something like that. But a friend of mine in that group we were brainstorming, and he came up with about a dozen suggestions. And one of them was Buddha at the Gas Pump. Okay. And everybody liked that one. So, yeah. So that's what I chose.
Okay.
Yeah. And I like that one because it, as you said, the implication is that ordinary people living ordinary, quote unquote, ordinary lives are having spiritual awakenings in this day and age. And that was true of many of the people in that group, actually. But some of them were hesitant to talk about them because when they did, their friends said, oh, you're just an ordinary guy. Who, you know, how could you possibly have something like this? And so I wanted to popularize the idea that this can happen to anybody. And we all have that birthright. We all have that potentiality. And so don't doubt that it's possible.
Hmm. And no wonder, yeah, it became so popular. I can see now the ray of not of, only of hope, but of empowerment of telling people, confirming, okay, you can also have an experience like that. You don't need to wait till some preliminary perfection and then this will come. But real perfection, as our a common friend of ours, Richard Roll, will say, real perfection is the inclusion of imperfection, not the exclusion of it. So even in the ordinary, the extraordinary can show up at any moment. Yeah, I always remember a quote from Thomas Merton, who I'm like a lot, the Christian mystic. He will say, your salvation begins in the most ordinary moments of your daily life. I really like that also.
Yeah, yeah.
Like in those moments you feel the most ordinary, if you remain open enough, you can also find the extraordinary always pouring in, so to say.
Yeah, and the extraordinary is really... I mean, what does the word extraordinary mean? It means it's just not common, but it doesn't mean it's unnatural or unreal. Mm-hmm. It's just not the common experience.
Yeah.
But theoretically, we could live in a world in which pretty much everybody was in some higher state of consciousness. And then all kinds of things that we consider to be super normal or, you know, just extraordinary would be, you know, no big deal. It's like, okay, let's go to lunch. We know about that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate it because as you mentioned, normal, what's normal? Generally we take for normal what has been normalized, right?
Yeah.
What has been standardized. But what if something else becomes normalized and standardized, like what you are trying to do with your podcast? It creates another definition of normal.
Imagine all the things that we now take for granted, like the technology that we're using to have this conversation. Mm-hmm. And imagine trying to describe that to somebody in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they would think you were crazy or they would think you were, you know, Jules Verne or something. But now everybody just, you know, takes this stuff for granted. So we get used to things that at one time seemed impossible.
And in that connection, Rick, something that comes to my mind is, okay, we take for granted, sometimes we can take for granted spirituality and sometimes we can take for granted the extraordinary, so to say. We are surrounded, in principle, if you pay enough attention, I will say we are surrounded by extraordinariness at every atom, at every pore of being.
Yeah.
We take for granted that.
It's all God. We're actually moving in and in the wholeness of the divine every moment. And we should be like... I saw a bumper sticker said if you're not in awe, you're not paying attention. But you know, our jaws would be dropping every second if we could really fathom the profundity of this very moment and every moment.
Yeah, Yeah, I can see also how it could be too much, but yeah, I can see also how many times we numb ourselves to an extraordinariness that we actually need to be in awe of sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
so
for
maybe
me,
I'm just saying the name of the game is to get unnumbed.
Amen. I agree. So you have been meditating almost for 60 years, if I didn't miss the math.
Something like that. In 2 years, 2 years or 3 years, it'll be 60.
Okay. We'll join the celebration for sure. So will you share with us some of the main jewels that have crossed your path looking back in almost six decades of sitting on a daily basis, which has been kind of the main, and I'm not asking here for any confidential detailed experiences, but just in general, some of the main lessons that sitting on a daily basis without basically failing for six decades had brought to your life.
Yeah. Firstly, I'm not an extremely disciplined person. My early life was rather difficult. My father had been severely traumatized by World War II, he was an alcoholic and very sensitive, intelligent man. He's a professional artist, but nonetheless, that made him all the more traumatized by World War II. And he was verbally abusive to my mother and when he was drunk, and my mother ended up trying to commit suicide three times and was in and out of mental hospitals. And I ended up getting into drugs and dropping out of high school and getting arrested a couple of times for drugs, and so my life was not going anywhere very productively. In the drug phase in 1967, a lot of us realized there's more to this than just fun. There's a spiritual significance, people like Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who became Ram Dass, were talking about the spiritual implications of this. And that really caught my attention. It kind of dawned on me that there was this deeper reality. And so I started reading Zen books and things like that. So one night after about a year of taking drugs and occasionally reading Zen books, I was sitting there high on something, couldn't go to sleep, picked up a Zen book and started reading. And it just hit me that, wow, these guys were really serious and I'm just fooling around. And if I keep fooling around like this, I'm just going to end up nowhere, probably end up dead. And so I just had this impulse to stop taking drugs and learn to meditate. And at the time, transcendental meditation was very common and available. And the Beatles had just, learned it and popularized it a few months beforehand. And so I decided to learn that. And there's a whole story about how I got from Connecticut into New York and to learn. It's kind of an adventure. But anyway, I learned. And from the very first sitting, I just felt a deep, deep, deep peace, relaxation, blissfulness. And I just loved it. And I felt like even after one sitting, I felt like a load had been taken off my shoulders. So I just took to it and started doing it regularly. I always managed to prioritize it. And, I wouldn't eat dinner unless I'd meditated first or whatever. And I just stuck with it. And after a couple of years, I became a teacher and started teaching full time and was very busy doing that, teaching a lot of people. And then I started, traveling around, giving bigger lectures and TV shows and things like that. And then after a couple of years of that, I ended up in Switzerland with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and spent several years over there. And meanwhile, during this whole period, we would take off every 4.5 months and do about a month or 6 weeks of long meditations in Switzerland or Mallorca or someplace. And so that became my life. And meanwhile, all kinds of transformation taking place, steady growth, and I just stuck with it. Now, maybe that's enough talking for this. At this point, maybe you want to throw in a question.
I have a question. Yeah, you read my mind. So your ears of meditation are bearing fruit now.
Yeah, I'm turning into a mind reader. I had a real funny experience this morning. I had a dream just before I woke up that I got a message on my computer that I was supposed to install a new operating system called Google Death. And I thought in my dream, I thought, ooh, this is suspicious. I think I'll check with my computer expert friend, who is a real friend, before I install this thing. And so this morning I emailed, but then I woke up. So this morning I emailed him about that dream. And he said, that's funny. Just yesterday, I was watching a TikTok video about the death of Google.
So, watch out with Rick, guys. If you're watching this episode, he may be reading your mind at this time.
Yeah.
I was thinking, first of all, Rick, of course, I can relate a lot to your own story, not to compare and reduce your own story to mine, because that's never possible, but in a different way. But yeah, father on some level, emotionally unavailable in my case, though very loving at the same time, very sensitive, but not having enough toolkit to deal with certain nuances and complexities. And as a teenager, also experimenting with substances and connecting with Buddhism to begin with. Then I went further into Hinduism and more specifically into my tradition. And I want to ask you, my question was related to your experience with substances, because you share with me some brief excerpt of your journey and story in a written form. And you mentioned that LSD, and you mentioned Timothy Leary and Ram Dass, was an eye-opener, which I will say was an eye-opener for me in my teenage years as well. But you also felt that you were just screwing around, in your own words, if I'm paraphrasing correctly. So my question will be, how do you distinguish between a real mystical glimpse and psychic stimulation, so to say, for those people who are really into a sincere search and sometimes may put all in the same place or be reductionistic or just also stigmatize all forms of substances, which some of them, of course, could have a healing, eye-opening purpose at some stage of the journey. Any thoughts you have on that?
Yeah. Well, with regard to drugs like that, Alan Watts said, when you get the message, hang up the phone. And so the message I got, you know, from the very first time was, whoa, people see the world so differently. I had always assumed that everybody saw the same world, you know, and here I am on LSD having this very different experience than I had ever had. And like, you know, that morning we went into a donut shop to get some donuts, and I was just still kind of high, you know, and I was looking at the ladies selling us donuts, and I was thinking, wow, I'm seeing the world so differently than I think they are. And so I can never forget
what's normal, right? What's normal?
Yeah. So I could never forget that. I can never forget that the name of the game is really to change the way you see the world more than to change the world, although that could use some changing too. But the key factor is to, you know, change your level of consciousness. But then, you know, the screwing around part, I was smoking grass most days. And, you know, towards the end, I actually, you know, did heroin a couple of times. So, I was being a total hypocrite if I thought that this had anything to do with getting enlightened. And I just realized I had to clean up my act. Now, you know, these days I have probably a similar attitude to yours, which is that there can be great benefit in some of these substances for certain people. I mean, they've done all kinds of research at Johns Hopkins and places like that on, you know, people suffering from PTSD or alcoholism or things like that, getting tremendous benefit. So that's wonderful. I question whether there's a value for many people in making drug use a long-term practice. You know, I know there are people who do it take ayahuasca or psilocybin or something every weekend. And from what I hear, I don't interact with such people much myself, but from what I hear, it's just not producing the kind of results one would hope. And I think that we have in our neurophysiology the apparatus to create whatever chemicals the body needs, DMT or whatever, to elicit higher states of consciousness, but to do so in an abiding way, not a temporary way. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately, I think, what people should move on to once they've gotten a glimpse with some drug. And, you know, and I'm not saying they need to take a drug to even begin a regular spiritual practice. If you kind of realize that that would be a good thing to do, go ahead and do it. You don't need to take psychedelics first. Just start meditating or learn something and do it.
Yeah. Thank you, Rick.
Yeah.
Thank you. Going for a minute back and to your Buddha the Gas Pump podcast and in connection to a main theme that we would like to explore today in terms of ethics and spiritual integrity, you have now so far, if I'm not mistaken, interviewed like, what, 725 people or something? So from all kinds of paths, some more renowned, world-renowned, some more hidden, whatever. What has this diversity taught you about, first of all, what spiritual awakening really looks like across the board? And then I'll go more specifically to the main theme of spiritual ethics and so on.
Well, it's been really good for me to do this. It's like an advanced spiritual practice or something, talking to these people every week and preparing for the interviews. I usually convert their book or whatever into an audio file and put it on my phone, or maybe they have an audible version of it, or I take YouTube videos they've made and I extract the audio track and put that on my phone, and I listen to that while I walk around the park for a couple miles every day, 4 or 5 miles, and get my exercise. And so just, you know, they always say with regard to anything, and also with regard to spiritual practice, that to which you give your attention grows stronger in your life. So it's been really good for me to have my attention on this. And when I was back in the TM movement in the early days, I was kind of fanatical, as young people tend to be, and I thought that this was the best way and everybody should be doing this and so on. And you know, now I have a broader view. I mean, I don't think God thinks that way. I think there's many paths up the mountain and many different things that are helpful to people. So, you know, whatever works for you is great. And if something doesn't seem to be working, then maybe, you know, give it a chance to prove itself. But if it's really not working out, then look around, find something else. Now, I think I've strayed away from your question. What was the question?
No, it was totally fine. I was asking you what has your exposure to so much diversity of guests.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to you about how spiritual awakening looks like across the board, basically.
Right. So it's really enriched my own life. And I've made some wonderful friends. Now I've got a new one with you. Meeting all these wonderful people. Some of my best friends, I've never actually met in person, but we've struck up these great friendships. And I think that, you know, people are wired differently. As you know, as a bhakti, I guess you're a bhakti, you would say, that might be your wiring. Some people are more gyanis, they're more intellectual. Some are more activity-oriented, karma yogis. And we're not only just talking Hinduism, probably other traditions have similar classifications. But so the actual external appearance of a so-called spiritual person is going to differ. Some will be housewives, some will be scientists, some will be athletes. You know, they'll have all kinds of external dharmas. But internally, the experiences will differ too. I mean, according to your wiring, some will have more of a heart orientation, some more of an intellect orientation. But I think there's something more fundamental than all of those different faculties or ways of acting. And that is, we could call it pure consciousness. There are many synonyms for that. But I think probably that is the essential constituent or ultimate ingredient of spiritual development. And that's your true nature, you know. And I think, you know, just as different, let's say mirrors or things would reflect the sunlight differently, maybe in different colored pieces of glass would give different colors to the sunlight and so on. The sunlight itself is the same thing, same photons reflecting differently off different things. So like that, I think our true nature, the ultimate reality of the universe, the ultimate reality of us is the same for everyone, but it is reflected differently through different nervous systems, different lives. There was a group back in the 60s called the Incredible String Band, and I remember one line from their song was, "Light that is one, though the lamps be many."
Yeah, it reminds me, of course, I cannot but go to my own tradition, where reality is described as Advaigyan Tattva, which basically means non-dual consciousness.
Yeah.
And of course, on that non-dual foundation, unified wholeness, there is diversity that expresses out of that unified bedrock, so to say. So our philosophy is called bed a bed, like there's difference and non-difference paradoxically and simultaneously. So there's non-dual unity and there's diversity, but diversity, yeah, rooted in non-duality. So in that way, diversity is not a conflict, but it's a celebration or it's an ornamentation, if you will. And I really relate, Rick, what you mentioned about, I love what you said at the very beginning, like for you, your podcast is kind of a type of spiritual practice, because I mean, I'm not anyway close to your 725 guests in my own podcast, but I'm in my already recorded like 60 something, so 10%, getting closer.
Well, you're younger than I was when I started. When I started this, yeah.
Give me your blessings, please.
Yeah, I was like 60 when I started this. So, hey, man, you could be up to like a couple thousand by the time you're my age.
Receiving here live officially the blessings of the host of the Buddha, the Gaspar. Thanks so much.
Yeah. I just want to add, based upon something you just said, that you know, not only are the unity and the diversity compatible, but the unity enriches the diversity. There's a line in the Bhagavad Gita which says yoga karma sukoshalam, which means yoga is skill in action. Mm-hmm. So, you know, getting established in being, Nistragunya Bhavarjun, chapter 2, verse 45, leads to verse 48, established in yoga, perform action. Mm-hmm. And then action yoga is skill in action. So this is something which can and should enhance one's life, not only in terms of one's subjective fulfillment, but in terms of one's ability to do whatever you do, you know, be a better computer programmer or tennis player or, you know, parent or whatever.
It reminds also, again, going back to the Gita, the message that Krishna is like, acknowledge your adhikar, acknowledge your eligibility, your vocation, your nature, and act accordingly, even if imperfectly. Better that than being perfect at someone else's dharma or duty.
Yeah.
Just ascertain.
What is it? Because one can perform it, one's own dharma, though lesser in merit, is better than the dharma of another. Better is death than one's own dharma. The dharma of another brings danger. That's the verse you're alluding
to.
You're
a good student, Rick. Very good. Nice. I love to hear renditions of the Bhagavad Gita in so many different ways and words. So thank you. But yeah, I was just mentioning a minute ago how I appreciate your point of, in my own experience, having a podcast and inviting guests that I've never met in 3D, like you and others, it's a wonderful way to get to make new friends. And many of those friendships have lasted for years so far, and I've never met with them in 3D yet. And those friends connect me with other friends, and it's such an enriching circle of Sangha that, I mean, a few years ago, that I wouldn't have ever thought about that portal, that possibility. So yeah, really appreciate. For me, it's, and as you say, it's an invitation to absorption and attention and empathy, connecting with the world of the other person. As you say, you will listen their books or their lectures and prepare for the conversation, get to know the person. So it's a very, in one sense, in my opinion, a very intimate process, right, of bonding and connecting with a common with a common center, which for me sounds like paradise, right? That's the idea.
Yeah.
So Rick, one, going to maybe our main theme, if you will, if we want to label as such in this conversation, spiritual ethics and integrity, one of your biggest, from what you told me, one of your biggest concerns nowadays, and rightfully so, is ethics in spiritual practice and ethics probably specifically in spiritual organizations and leadership. So if I may ask you, why is this such a core issue, in your opinion, in today's spiritual landscape, especially among teachers? Again, I will go there.
Yeah, well, I could say a lot about this, and feel free to interrupt me if I go on too long.
Okay.
You know, I mean, as you were quoting, who was it, Thomas Merton or somebody earlier, you know, we don't come into this life as perfect human beings. If we were perfect, we wouldn't come into this life. Mm. And so we've all got stuff to work out. And and very often one can reach quite a high level of realization without having worked out a lot of stuff. Mm. Somebody I interviewed a few months ago had this theory that the chakras have like sheaths around them. And and you can sort of be bypass a particular chakra, maybe having enlivened it to a certain extent, if we want to go by the whole chakra model, and move to higher ones, but the lower ones have not been purified. And so you can ascend to quite a high level of realization, but then the lower ones can kind of kick in and start causing a lot of trouble, you know, like sexual things or yeah. whatever. And this is problematic because you've reached quite a level of power. You know, you might have a lot of shakti, a lot of eloquence, a lot of charisma. You might be quite an impressive character, and yet, you know, really kind of more base impulses, which should have been cleaned up a long time ago, start to act up. And then in a way you become kind of worse than the average teenager, you know? I mean, you just begin to, you know, there have been gurus who just had ridiculous sexual appetites and abusive tendencies and so on. Megalomania. It's almost like the ego gets all this fuel from the shakti you've built up, and just becomes exaggerated, you know, much more than the ordinary person. And so, you know, someone might say, well, so what? But the problem is that, you know, a spiritual teacher, especially one that has a lot of charisma and eloquence and so on, attracts a lot of followers. And those followers are, you know, precious. They're to the world. They're very sincere people with a very lofty aspiration. And they come into spiritual community innocently, naively. And then next thing you know, the guru is, you know, seducing some 17-year-old girl or asking people to give them his life savings or their life savings, or, you know, all kinds of violations that we could, you know, most of us have heard about these things. And this can be shattering for a young person or even an older person. But I know of instances where people committed suicide. They were so disillusioned by such treatment by a spiritual teacher. So I feel, as you probably do, that spirituality is the most critical ingredient for the betterment of the world. It needs to be awakened, and it is awakening globally. And that will be the ultimate solution to all our problems. Our problems, all the problems we have in the world, war and famine and environment and all these things, are really not problems. They're symptoms. Of a deeper problem, which is that we haven't really built the foundation, which would bring all these other things into proper alignment. So, you know, spiritual teachers have a tremendous responsibility, not only to their students, but to the world, to help bring about a transformation of humanity. And if they're fooling around like this because they themselves hadn't really undergone all the necessary development and training that ideally they should have, then they're doing a disservice, and they're hurting people while at the same time they might be helping people. I mean, a lot of people have gotten benefit out of being with some teacher who was kind of a mixed bag, but they're also hurting themselves, because I think there are karmic implications to doing something like this. So maybe that's enough. You should throw in a question.
There is a lot there, Rick. Yeah. I mean, there is a lot in a good sense. So thank you so much for that. I can relate to that a lot, of course. In my second book, I've written three books so far. The second is called Radical Personalism, and I spend a whole chapter, almost the longest chapter of the book, called Issues and Tissues Between Guru and Disciple. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, I made the play of words, issues and tissues. By tissues, I thought more like layers, but most people who read the book took tissues like the tears that come
like, from. You mean like tissues like Kleenexes?
Yeah. I mean, people were thinking tissues about napkins, Kleenex. I was referring to tissues like different layers of an issue.
Yeah, or most like the layers of your skin are different. They're
but
different.
People took tissues as a Kleenex because the issues between guru and disciple are so many sometimes that they require lots of
tragic.
Lots of tears there.
And I've gone, I have, we were talking before the recording a little bit, you asked about my story, who are you, where are you, who gave you the order of Swami and so on. We were introducing each other, and I told a little bit of my story with former gurus and situations of, again, in my opinion, abuse and dysfunctional, unintegrated humanity. So I have a question, because you mentioned this interesting idea right at the beginning, that someone can be very spiritually advanced, let's put it that way, or very much into the higher chakras, as you framed that, and not having integrated or dealt with or properly embraced the lower chakras, the more foundational stages. Right. I'm thinking about Ken Wilber, which I'm sure you know, and probably he has been in your podcast also. Yes. And he speaks a lot of the difference between waking up and growing up.
Right, and cleaning up also.
And cleaning up, yeah. Or sometimes we will speak about holiness, but what about wholeness, right?
Right.
So I'm saying all this because I've seen many people thinking that if you have waken up, necessarily that must include having grown up. Somehow from what you are saying, or Ken Wilber or others, it's like, that's not necessarily the case, right? You may be very spiritually enlightened or advanced, but at the same time having some more foundational layers not fully in place. So I don't know if you can unpack a little bit that possibility of not necessarily one thing implying the other.
Yeah. Well, another thing Ken Wilber says in this context is he speaks of lines of development. And, you know, we could, I don't know how many lines that he enumerates, but, you know, intellect, heart, behavior, perception, you know, empathy, all kinds of different lines of development that human beings have to varying degrees. And my original teacher, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, used to say that they're all tightly correlated, and that to whatever extent you develop samadhi, all the other limbs are going to come along, all the other lines. You'll be a more ethical person, a happier person, a healthier person, you know, all these things. But that wasn't the what I observed. And Ken Wilber asserts that these lines are, you know, very loosely correlated, if at all. And, you know, you can advance quite far along a certain line, but be really quite stunted along some other lines. And so I think it probably takes, you can't assume that just because you're meditating or, you know, having some nice experiences or something, that all the other things are just going to fall into line. That one of my favorite quotes is from Padmasambhava, the Buddhist avatar or whatever he was. He said that although my awareness is as vast as the sky, my attention to karma is as fine as a grain of barley flour. And so what he's saying there is that, you know, I'm a pretty cosmic guy, but I have to keep an eye on myself. You know, I can't just do whatever comes to mind. I have to be precise. And along a similar line, Carlos Castaneda's teacher, Don Juan, said, a warrior has time only for his impeccability. Mm. So I think we have to, I mean, if we're serious about spiritual development, we should strive to culture all aspects of our personality and our life. Mm-hmm. We can't, you know, we can't sort of assume that because we have some sense of non-dual awakening or something that we can do whatever we want. And, you know,
which is what sometimes is being said when some of these gurus end up doing stuff that is unbecoming. It's like, well, they are so high that whatever they do is, they are beyond it, and even they are purifying the people that they are doing all that stuff to. I've heard all that stuff.
Me too. They use it as an alibi. I mean, I've heard people say, you know, firstly, all the world is an illusion, so you can do whatever you want in the world because you know it's an illusion. Mm-hmm. And others say, okay, I'm not seducing these women. God is doing it because I'm essentially one with God. And so don't blame me, you know, and just nutty excuses like that. I don't buy it. Anyway.
Thank you for sharing that. And I think there is, at least thinking of my own community, but of course I know it's beyond it as well. There's so much more conversation to be had about discerning properly between waking up, growing up, again, cleaning up. These are not exactly the same thing. And as you say, what to speak, just having charisma or just having knowledge doesn't imply spiritual realization, and just and having spiritual realization, as you're saying, doesn't imply that every other department has been well attended, so to say, emotionally, psychically. And I've had my own experience with people who I perceive they are very spiritually advanced. They have so much knowledge. They're intellectually brilliant, like geniuses. And they are in very primitive places in terms of their emotional life and how they react. They're very triggered by very basic things. They're overreacting, as Carl Jung will say. You want to know what's in your subconscious, pay attention to your triggers. And at the same time, the other thing is happening. So it's paradoxical for most people. I can see how it's overwhelming for people. But he's so charismatic, so much knowledge, so much. I felt this experience when he said that. And at the same time, I'm hearing that he's doing or saying this and that. So it's very nice.
And it can be confusing. I mean, a student might be sitting there and they're so impressed with their teacher, and their life has been enhanced by association with him. And yet they can see, and maybe they learn more and more as the longer they're there, that there's something wrong here in his behavior. But a lot of people just say, well, who am I to judge? You know, I'm just an ignorant schmuck, and this guy is supposed to be enlightened. And so, you know, maybe it's crazy wisdom. So I'll just keep sitting here, you know, but it's not crazy wisdom. It's not wisdom if it's that crazy, if it's destructive. I mean, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche and Alan Watts both died of alcoholism in their 40s, think about that. I mean, if you're supposed to be in some enlightened state, would you really feel that getting drunk was enhancing your enlightenment? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think so. I know in my own case, once I learned to meditate, I very quickly lost the desire for any substances like that, because I started to feel better all the time than those things had made me feel temporarily.
Very similar to me. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you know, if I had done them again, I would have wanted to get them out of my system as quickly as possible, because I wouldn't like the effect.
So Rick, in connection to what we have been talking so far, I'd like to go to the Association for Spiritual Integrity that, if I'm not mistaken, you have co-founded.
So
if you would like to introduce us to which are some of the most recurring themes, and of course they may be connected to some of the most recurring ethical blind spots that most of us have seen across communities and teachers. So if you'd like to share any thoughts about that.
So there was this conference for many years out in California called the Science and Non-Duality Conference, and I attended I attended that about 10 times, and I think it was maybe 2017 or 18, I gave a talk on the ethics of enlightenment. And it turned out that a couple of my friends gave talks on a similar topic, and unbeknownst to each other. And so they attended that talk, my talk, and we had lunch afterwards and decided to start an organization which now is called the Association for Spiritual Integrity. And those friends were Jack O'Keefe, who's from Ireland, and Craig Holiday, from here in the States. So we started it, and it's evolved now to the point where we have about 800 members and about 60 member organizations. And we've given presentations at Harvard Divinity School and the Parliament of World Religions and all kinds of things. And we've had many webinars which were given or hosted by various interesting people. And it's picking up steam. There's a need for it, and a lot of people just have been concerned about the kinds of things that you and I have been talking about today, and they feel that they would like to be part of an organization that is helping to raise awareness of these issues of ethics on the spiritual path. Mm-hmm. And our friend Swami Sarvapriyananda often says that you can have ethics without enlightenment, but you can't have enlightenment without ethics. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest, just my opinion, I have no proof of it, but I would suggest that these people who seem to be really enlightened, but who are unethical aren't. And I guess that requires that we define the term enlightenment.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, any word that we use, unless we all agree on its meaning, is kind of useless, because we're talking, it's like Tower of Babel. We're talking about different things when we think we're communicating.
Yeah.
So, you know, my sense of what enlightenment is a holistic development, like we were talking about Ken Wilber's lines of development.
Yeah. Carl Jung himself saying, for me, enlightenment is wholeness, not so much like transcendence or rising up, but going down and integrating, yeah.
Right. So the transcendence needs to be there, but everything else needs to be in line with it. So it's a lifelong process, and maybe there's no end to it. I mean, St. Teresa of Avila said it appears that God himself is on the journey.
Sorry to make a promotion here, but this is my last book, recent book, and the subtitle is The Eternal Becoming of God, Soul, and Matter.
Great,
so
yeah.
I'm totally on the same page, literally.
Yeah. So the whole universe is just, you know, it's all God evolving, and we are little cells in that giant body of God. And so we're evolving. And I feel like there's probably no end to it. And that's fine. I mean, pardon?
That's exciting for me, at least.
Yeah, me too. And back in my younger days, when I wasn't so happy, I would feel like, oh God, this has got to be my last lifetime. You know, I just want to get off the wheel and merge into the absolute and never
exist. An evacuation plan into the afterlife, if some will put it. Yeah.
Yeah. These days I feel like whatever the setup, I'm happy to participate. You know, if there's more lifetimes, if there's no more lifetimes, whatever. But I certainly don't feel like I've reached the end of my potential spiritual development, and you know, I might live another 20 years if I'm lucky, and I don't think I will have reached it then, so I'll be happy to continue in whatever realm.
Say, the question is there an actual end to your potential in spirituality? That's for me.
Yeah, I don't think so. That's my opinion. I don't think so.
That's mine as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, spiritual-integrity.org is the URL of the ASI if people want to check it out.
Thank you. And of course, something that we were talking is that, to clarify, since you mentioned the importance of, and I would do that a lot in my presentations, whenever I use some word or someone asks me something about one word, it's like, what do you mean by that word first? Let's go to grammar, let's redefine if it's necessary. What do we mean by that word? So by integrity, I don't think we are talking here about being moralistic or telling people what to do, and just a sense of correctedness from a place of superiority or ego or formulaic following of this or that. But for me, integrity, and I want to hear your thoughts, but integrity entails the word integration. And for me, I go again back to wholeness there, like to give everything its place of dignity, and everything is part of the same equation, as Richard Rohr will say, everything belongs. So how to find the place that where everything belongs in its proper healthy expression? Integration, and for me that takes to integrity, and not so much like a whole bunch of what to do from a very cold-hearted place or superiority place, hierarchical place. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, that's good. I'm glad you brought it up. And usually people who are fond of telling people what to do aren't doing it themselves. Yeah. They turn out to be hypocrites. So, certainly in the ASI, we don't want, and we have a kind of a whole list of points or tenets that spiritual teachers might want to abide by, but we're not policing them. You know, we're not going to hand out tickets if they don't abide by them. We're just suggesting these as standards that and I often think of it mainly from the student's perspective. These are standards that students should expect teachers to live up to. And if they aren't living up to them, don't make excuses for them. You know, maybe leave, or maybe bring it to their attention that, you know, something could be improved. But in any case, the ASI is not a moralistic, authoritarian kind of an organization. We're just offering a service to perhaps raise awareness of the importance of ethics on the spiritual path.
I really appreciate it, Rick. And I recently, actually, after talking to you and you shared me the link, I went to the website and I joined the group. So I'm part of it on some level to begin with, at least initial levels. So I'm happy to be part of that. And I was checking the website. I still have my homework to do, but I'm really appreciate it. It has an honor code for individuals, honor code for organizations, honor code for students, not student guidelines. So feedback forms for teachers and peer support, which I think is so important for, especially for teachers, going for a moment to the teachers, spiritual guides, spiritual mentors. I've seen so much time disastrous scenarios with teachers just because they don't have feedback. They don't have one-to-one equals peers that are there to hear them, to receive them, and they become somehow isolated into a crystal bubble at the top of the hierarchy, and that's so lonely there. They're just themselves there, feeling lonely, and many times they end up finding company, trying to not be so lonely, and ending up doing not very nice things. And I'm not saying that to just justify anything that may have happened, but just to analyze.
No, it's important.
Bigger picture and how providing feedback and allowing teachers to not isolate themselves is protecting them and protecting the community, right?
Yeah, no, that is important. There a lot of times teachers don't really have any friends other than their students. Mm-hmm. And that can be problematic, you know, because if they want a romantic relationship or something else, if they were a licensed psychotherapist, they would lose their license for and possibly even go to jail for doing such mm-hmm. a thing. But there's no regulation like that in the spiritual community. And this, regarding the feedback, you know, there are some teachers who it's kind of rare for a teacher to be just totally open and vulnerable to feedback. Usually they don't want to hear it. And sometimes people who offer it are kicked out of the group. And, you know, I think it's really important to have it. And because, you know, what is that? There's a poem by Robert Burns about something, the gift of being able to see ourselves as others see us. Mm. You know, I mean, we just can't see our own blind spots. That's why they're called blind spots. But others can see them. And if we're open to feedback and if we're willing to take it seriously, then maybe it could be an opportunity for the teacher to grow.
Of course.
Which he's missing out on if he's closed to it.
Exactly. Totally agree with that. Blind spots and shadows. Again, shadow work, this terminology, Jungian terminology of the shadow, and acknowledging, normalizing the fact that even if you're a teacher, you have your shadow. So let's make that part of the normal again.
Yeah.
Many times I like to think we end up stigmatizing things that we should be normalizing.
Right.
especially when it comes to spiritual authorities and there's so much pressure, social, people want to belong, but many times they end up fitting in. And the fitting in is just not seeing things that they should be seeing, not speaking things that they feel they need to speak because they want so badly to belong, but they mistake belonging with fitting in and they end up compromising their own integrity. And then we know.
Then the whole organization goes off the rails. I mean, you know, if nobody's willing to course correct, you know, mm-hmm. the whole thing just gets, and you've seen that. I mean, we've all seen cults that just get very strange and, you know, end up killing themselves or, you know, just doing weird things. And it's like, it doesn't happen overnight. It's incremental, you know, mm-hmm. small shift by small shift, they get more and more off track. And that also is true of the individuals in them, but also the entire group. And usually you don't get out of them overnight either. And it can take a long time to kind of decondition yourself from the group mentality that you have been raised in for, you know, some years in many cases.
Yeah. That's for me, at least personally, so healing and healthy as a mentor that I play that role. And at the same time, I consider myself an eternal student. That's the only way I can be sober and protected. When I'm trying to mentor someone, I'm still a student and I'm always learning.
Yep.
Trying to facilitate group conversations or circle talking, so to say, where we are all sitting as brothers and sisters. I'm not against any form of hierarchy, every form of hierarchy, sorry, but at the same time, even if there's some elder or senior or teacher, there should be a willingness, as you say, to learn, to listen, to have feedback, and to be vulnerable. I think that's, for me, a very important word that many times we are too afraid to deal with, being vulnerable and being naked and being raw and opening and receiving feedback from a place of concern and care and love, right? So, because if not, I've seen teachers getting so, developing a religious persona and getting so much attached to that particular persona as if it's their identity. So whenever that persona has some problem, if they have to acknowledge that they are bereft of identity and they go there, nobody can live without a sense of identity. So they cling even stronger to the mask, so to say.
Yeah. I think it was Yogananda who talked about his teacher, Sri Yukteswar, and how if someone criticized him, he wouldn't become defensive. He would become introspective. And he would just really search within himself to see whether that criticism had merit. And it, you know, not all criticism would have merit necessarily, but at least he would look carefully to see whether it did. And, yeah, you know, maybe try to change something if necessary.
Yeah, yeah. So in your particular journey and experience, which patterns or red flags, so to say, have you learned to spot, even if I may say in your guests, in your podcast over the years, some sign of spiritual bypassing or inflation or confusion? I don't know.
Yeah, I've taken down about 25 interviews of some, a few cases it was people wanted it taken down because maybe they were getting into some business thing and they didn't want their spiritual life on public display. But in many cases, it was turned out that someone had, I mean, in one case, turned out the guy had drugged and raped underage girls when he was younger and done many other things and not admitted to it. And one of the girls he had raped got in touch with me and said, you know, this guy is bad news. You know, when we heard the whole story, we took it down. Yeah. You know, there are cases where people have ripped people off financially. I can think of two cases where, you know, the teacher was talking people into giving him their entire life savings or inheritance and then not giving it back when they realized they'd made a mistake and things like that. So, we feel that we have a responsibility in, in a way, doing one of these interviews is a promotion that they get a lot of public attention. And even if there are other interviews where they've gotten a lot more attention than from mine, I don't want to contribute to the situation if the teacher is behaving unethically. And so we'll take the interview down. And sometimes I get criticism for that, particularly by people who are still followers of that teacher. Why did you take it? He's wonderful. You shouldn't have taken it down. But I don't care. I can take the criticism. We just want this to be a service to people. And we want it to be trustworthy, kind of like the good housekeeping seal of approval, you know, where you can trust that if we've got somebody up there, they're not behaving irresponsibly.
Yeah, yeah. We've talked about this a little bit, Rick, but do you think that ethics must precede awakening necessarily, or can awakening sometimes precede ethics and correct it from within, or both? Will you say that there's one way in which it happens? What has been your experiencing so far, also witnessing so many other cases and people and teachers and journeys?
I think that a degree of awakening can precede ethical development, but but only to a certain extent, only to a certain limit. Because if the ethical thing isn't taken care of, it's going to trip the person up. You know, the problems are going to arise, and they will perhaps be what is sometimes traditionally called a fallen yogi. So I think that it's, and that is not to say that you should just, you know, work on your ethics, and then when you've got them all 100% clean, then you're going to start on your spiritual practices. I think you should do both. And working on ethics, what does that mean? It might mean getting some kind of therapy, or it might just mean, I mean, I've never had therapy. Maybe I could have benefited from it, but it might just mean being honest and self-scrutinizing and, you know, being careful in your behavior so as not to harm people. I mean, that's the basic thing. I mean, I still feel guilty about, you know, the way I broke up with a girlfriend 55 years ago, you know, just because it was just insensitive and cruel. And you know, it bothers me to this day that I did that. And so I think it's good to be mindful. And I don't know how you can instill this in people, or maybe just talking about it helps people realize that it's something they could do. Because, you know, what are you going to do about these teachers who are, you know, being sexually promiscuous or, you know, taking advantage of people in that and other ways? They're probably not going to listen to this interview. I don't know. You just do what you can. Maybe starting with yourself and starting by walking your own talk. But hopefully such values will spread. And, you know, maybe 10, 20 years from now, we'll see a lot less of the kind of bad behavior in the spiritual community that we still see today.
Yeah, that reminds me, in our tradition, the notion of sattva or balance or goodness as actually preliminary to actual transcendence. So
it is, yeah.
Having the house in order on some degree, as you say, not 108% impeccable, and only then I think about spirituality, but some reasonable foundation of sattva to be balanced enough in my humanity, spirituality, psychology, and I can have a more realistic picture of spirituality, because if not, probably I have so many projections of my own unresolved stuff into what God looks like, what a guru is, what spiritual experience is, and I go with all that bunch of projections and lenses, and then in the name of God, in the name of absolute truths, we can end up doing the worst and justifying that in the worst possible ways as it continues to happen, right?
Yeah. Speaking of Swami Sarvapriyananda again, I was in a class with him a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about how it's more important to have a pure mind than a subtle mind. He said you can have a subtle mind but not be a very pure person. And you could have a pure mind and not be like a big intellect or, you know, really smart person in the ordinary sense, but that purity is more critical for spiritual awakening than subtlety. And it reminds me of a story of Trotikacharya, who was one of Shankara's four chief disciples. Okay. And the other three of the four were, you know, towering intellects. They were these really brilliant guys, and they would work with Shankara on his commentaries and everything. And Trotikacharya was kind of a simple guy, but very pure. And he would be down at the river washing the clothes and stuff like that while the other disciples were working on their on the commentaries. But he was the one who got enlightened first, and you know, and became sort of the leader of the whole thing.
I love the idea in our particular Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. That's very relatable, because we conceive that the highest devotees of Krishna are the gopis and gopas of Vrindavan, who are basically uncivilized tribal people, but who had such a
devotion,
great heart.
So
innocent, so pure, and they just give their lives in pure love to the divine. But at least apparently in the dynamics of their lila or love play, they are not, again, PhD intellectuals bringing knowledge here and there, but they are utterly very simple, very deep, very good-hearted. Yeah,
you can think of St. Francis as another nice example. Did you ever see that movie, Brother, Son, Sister, Moon, about the life of... So there was that scene where he goes to meet the Pope, you know, and here he is with his little ragtag group, you know, in their burlap clothing or whatever, and the Pope is there in all of his finery, and Pope recognizes, whoa, this guy is special, and he gets down and kisses his feet or something. And then reluctantly, the Pope has to get back up on his throne, and you know, St. Francis looks kind of sorry for him.
From at least the time we are recording this episode, in a week or so, I will be visiting Italy, and I will be going to Assisi.
Nice.
As I did last year, one of my favorite places in the world, and especially St. Francis' tomb. That was like something last year. I remember we all went there first time, first place. We had other places to go, and we were all like, we don't want to go anywhere apart from this particular spot here. So
that's great.
Really touched by St. Francis and other saints from, of course, every tradition. And I'm thinking St. Therese of Lisieux and her little way, where she will just invest her whole being and heart in the smallest daily acts, as you were given the example of this menial servant of Shankara washing cloth. But you can really, or Brother Lawrence's practice of the presence, where you just invest all your faculties into peeling a potato for the love of God, so to say. And you can attain all perfection from that. One of our teachers will say that. If you learn to relate to a blade of grass for what the blade of grass actually is, you can attain all perfection.
Yeah. Right? That's an interesting thought. I often think about blades of grass and what's maybe from more of a scientific perspective, but what's actually going on in them with all the thousands and thousands of cells and each cell being this incredibly complex structure. And I kind of take that sort of thought as evidence of the existence of God. It's like God is kind of hiding in plain sight if we consider the profundity and intricacy of every little thing in the that we encounter.
In our tradition, we literally say God is residing in every atom. So
exactly, and that, you know, I mean, and what that really means is, I mean, if you look at the way an atom works, which we don't fully understand, it's this profoundly intelligent little mechanism. And what is that intelligence that is, you know, governing the laws of nature that control the atom, or that control a cell, or that control, you know, nuclear fusion or whatever? It's that intelligence which pervades the whole universe. God is an old-fashioned word for it, but that's what it is.
Yeah, we also need to redefine what do we mean by God every time we use the word.
Yep.
Rick, I don't want to take much more time from your morning walk that you are about to have in a few minutes. But if you give me a few more minutes, I'd like to conclude our conversation with a few short questions that I always like to bring to my guests. And I will expect some similarly short answers, like back and forth, fired questions, short questions, honest answers, no overthinking. Again, going back to the simple-hearted transparency and spiritual integrity, if you're okay with that.
Sure.
Thank you.
It's a test whether I can give a short answer.
Let's see. That's a good discipline. I mean, again, conciseness is not my highest quality either. So
yeah.
I'm with you in that one. Okay, let's go with the first one. A moment of awakening that still gives you goosebumps.
I had this dream one time where I was ushered into a room and made to lie down on my stomach and hold on to some handles, and some being with a trident stabbed my chakras up and down my back for quite some time, and it was this agonizing thing. But I held on for dear life, and when I came up out of it, I felt utterly transformed. I was walking around in a state of awe for several days, and I later heard that in Tibetan Buddhism there's some practice where you're supposed to imagine Lord Shiva stabbing your chakras with a trident, and I figured, oh, maybe some guy had that experience and reverse engineered it.
Thank you. The second one, which is a shadow in our spiritual community at large that we are not talking about enough.
Well, you and I have talked about a lot of them today. I would just say to reiterate something we've already said, which is the lack of proper emphasis on ethics on the spiritual path, and the lack of proper adherence to ethics by too many spiritual teachers. Not all, but too many.
Okay. Which is one thing, Rick, that you wish more spiritual teachers will admit.
Admit and try to remedy, try to correct, you know, to give it more emphasis in their own lives. They don't even have to preach it to their students if they're adhering to it more fully, then the students will pick up on that.
Okay. Which is a line from the sacred scriptures, whichever that you carry in your pocket and in your heart at every breath.
Well, it's not exactly from a sacred scripture, but a line from the Incredible String Band, I think I might have quoted them earlier, is, whatever you think, it's more than that.
Yeah, that makes me think of Meister Eckhart saying, if you can think it, it's not God.
Good point. Yeah.
Similar. Yeah. What's the hardest part of interviewing 700 plus awakened beings?
Oh, there's not. Usually it's technical stuff, you know, like having computer problems and having to figure out some, you know, that kind of stuff. There's nothing hard about the interviewing. I think it's easy. I find it easy and enjoyable.
Beautiful. So who is one guest that surprised you the most and why?
Oh, golly. I don't know if I can answer that. There have been so many of them, and I've forgotten, you know, the details of most of them. I'm not usually surprised, because I've usually gotten to know them quite well by the time I interview them, mm-hmm. but I'm kind of inspired by how many wonderful people there are in this world, who are doing wonderful things with their lives. It makes me optimistic. And, you know, if your only understanding of the world was watching the news, you could become very depressed and pessimistic, but there's something going on in this world that doesn't make it to the evening news. And it gives me hope for humanity.
Thank you. Yeah, there is hope. A few more. A practice that you secretly wish more people will try, which is that?
I don't know about secretly, but I think that it would be good for people to find a regular spiritual practice that works for them and that they enjoy, so that they do it regularly. Mm-hmm. And if they don't enjoy it, they're not going to do it regularly. So, you know, find a meditation or chanting or whatever kind of practice you actually enjoy that kind of you look forward to doing every mm-hmm. day, and do it.
Thank you. You are doing great with conciseness, Rick, by the way.
Yeah.
Three more questions and we are done. Which is a spiritual cliche that you will love to see retired?
Oh, golly. this is hard. Coming up with these things.
Sorry, you're in the hot seat now.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's some cliches that are thrown about that seem superficial, but that are actually, I believe in them. Like, for instance, everything happens for a reason. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a reason that you can figure out intellectually, but I don't think the world is arbitrary. I think mm-hmm. that every little leaf that falls is in tune with some divine purpose or cosmic intelligence. Mm-hmm. And if you can learn to see the world that way, that it's all the play and display of divine intelligence, then perhaps you can be more in tune with that play and not oppose it. I don't know about one that I wish would go away. Maybe you can name me one and I'll see if I agree with you.
That was the answer that came. It was the important thing is you are being honest.
Okay. Yeah.
What breaks your heart the most in the name of spirituality?
What we've been talking about, people entering into spirituality with all sincerity, being disillusioned by teachers that probably shouldn't be teaching because they obviously have proven themselves not ready to teach, not fully ethical yet, yeah. or ethical enough anyway. And I would encourage people who do get disillusioned like that not to give up. Maybe take your disillusionment as a learning experience and become wiser as a result, you know, thereby. But don't conclude that there's nothing to this spiritual business, you yeah. know, just keep on trucking, as the Grateful Dead said.
And probably the last one you already just replied, but if your soul had one sentence to whisper to this generation, what will it be?
To this generation, I guess you mean the young generation or?
Yeah.
Make hay while the sun shines. I mean, life is a precious opportunity for spiritual advancement. It's not just about making money or having fun or having pleasurable experiences. There's a reason why we're born into this life, and there's a higher purpose to it. Try to realize that purpose, and when you come to the end of your life, you'll be happy you did.
Rick, thank you so much for joining us in conversation. It has been a pleasure for me to
have you. Yeah, thanks. Let's stay in touch.